Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the purposes of the other people here, a printed copy of my legal submissions is hopefully underway up at the reception desk at the moment. But I've got a copy from your your secretary's side and may start on those.
Yes.
And just in terms of sequence, as I discussed with you before the lunch break, bring the other people involved with me up here. And Mr. Geddes's evidence was pre-circulated or pre-lodged. So
not
he...
Not from the lodgement date, but 2 days ago.
Yes, that's true.
I'm not asking for reasons. I'm just stating the fact. I haven't had a chance to read it all yet, but hopefully there'll be some.
So in that case, I will get him to read it out, and Mr. Williams likewise is going to read his evidence, and Scott Freeman will speak. And so we put the right sequences for me to present these legal submissions. I wasn't going to summarise my evidence. He had that for some time, and to some extent, I've picked up what's in my evidence and my legal submissions, which are intended. Sorry, my submissions. So
I can't imagine that you would deviate.
No, and these are more intended to be to pick up responses to other people, and also that in the last few days we've done a track change rewrite of the plan provisions, and I want to just pick up some of that. Okay. These submissions are intended to support the evidence of a number of Jack's Point residents who share a common vision about what the Jack's Point settlement is and how development of it should be completed in order to realise the original vision that its lead designer John Darby has so often spoken about and is described in material I have referenced in my evidence and which can still be found on the Jack's Point website. It may be that this council is persuaded to embark on major urban expansion, and if you find as a panel that is appropriate and deemed necessary, then no doubt there will be provision for considerable expansion of urban built development and provision for intensification of some existing residential areas. But in my submission, the master plan Jack's Point settlement is not such an area. I submit it should not have been included within the definition of urban development in Chapter 2 of the proposed district plan. If it had been realistic to appear at that time, which it wasn't to me, I would have said so then, and I apologise that mainly due to my unitary plan commitments in Auckland, it's only been possible for me to come down to once.
We haven't heard the definition yet.
Well, then I can say it now without any problems. I'm just not even up to date with the sequence of your hearings and how they've been working.
Yes. The next hearing is from Mr. Bradford, who is the definitions.
Yes. Right. So I'd like you to take into account what I'm going to say now.
Yes.
In paragraph 2.3 of the submissions for the council, reference is made to the definition of urban development. By reference to that definition, I submit that the Jack's Point settlement as designed and substantially established is not of an urban character typically associated with urban areas. And I wanted to have an opportunity during our later discussion with you to talk about the site visit, which I understand you're going to make,
yes.
Because I think it would be good if the residents here, and I'm more of a part-timer obviously than the others, can say something to you about where we'd like you to go. Within and around the Jack's Point settlement to look at what's there on the ground already. In that respect, it is notable that the Millbrook settlement is excluded. There should be Jack's Point. Both these developments were designed around a golf course facility with associated visitor accommodation and facilities. And I recall from the Skydive hearing, which you may know I was involved in for JKROA, that John Darby's evidence was that the original intention was the lodge that sits up above the golf course was to be the first of the elements that were going to be built. And if you look at variation 16, which I've given you, it actually confirms that. So the lodge has actually been delayed and the residential has gone before the lodge. So accommodation was always forefront. So a golf course facility with associated visitor accommodation and facilities. The council submissions identify both locations as being provided for in the resort chapters. And I do think that if you recognise that things are planned and provided for but may not have been built yet, and frankly the real reason that I learned from the skydive here is why the lodge is there is because of the skydive operation. It passes within a couple of, well, less than 100 feet over the top of the lodge. But you recognise that as being part of what was proposed, and it is a resort development in the same way as Millbrook. It may be, as the council's landscape expert has suggested, that the more intensive form of residential development that does not share any of the distinctive features of the Jack's Point settlement already underway on the Hanley Downs land is the beginning of a large area of conventional urban development that will extend north, utilising the current open farmland adjoining State Highway 6. The park consented first stage of subdivision of the Hanley Downs land, and I think my evidence gave you a copy of what that actually looks like. Has the intensity, visual character, trip generation, design and appearance of urban character. Jack's Point settlement is designed, laid out and substantially completed. Does not have an urban character typically associated with urban areas. As stated in the operative zone provisions, the protection of visual amenity and landscape values are of critical importance in the development of the zone. This is what the OGP says. And its successful integration into the wider outstanding natural landscape. This is achieved in part through the structure plan and in part through the external appearance, bulk and location of buildings constructed within the zone. And that's what has happened. The operative plan provisions for the resort zones commences by referring to the Millbrook Resort and Jack's Point in the following way. The council recognises the potential of the Millbrook Resort and Jack's Point to contribute to visitor and economic development within the district. This will arise from increased employment and visitor activity generated by the zones. Both zones provide for golf courses and a range of outdoor and indoor sporting and recreational activities. In Millbrook Resort, hotel and other visitor accommodation exist along with support facilities and services. Similar developments are proposed for Jack's Point, and that's very much the case. The resort zone recognises the special amenities of the rural area in which the development is located and provides for the ongoing implementation of the activities of the resort.
Can we just discuss the urban issue now?
Yes, I do go on to refer to the urban development capacity statement.
Yes, but we'll worry about that later. What I'm interested in, presumably you're familiar with, Planning Map 13, which seems to show an urban growth boundary around Jack's Point.
So you mean extending as far south to include Jack's Point?
Yes.
Yes, I do understand that to be the case.
Yes, but I wondered if you had any comments on, given your statement about the Hanley Downs section, whether you had any view on whether that boundary could be in a different location.
Well, this is, I've done it before, but of course I'm here as an individual, and I've been careful. I'm trying to be careful about how I present things, but if I may, I would say, appearing as I am as a witness, and I can't ignore the experience I've had, and coming from outside Queenstown as it were, it seems to me that whilst I consider it being extremely regrettable that that scenic corridor approaching Queenstown that I've just referred to, down past the entrance of the ski field, would become urbanised like, say, Lake Hayes, I recognise it might happen. But I would respectfully suggest that Jack's Point provides, in the way it has been designed and developed and is actually locked in, now, in terms of what has happened there, the perfect transition from urban expansion out to and including the Hanley Downs land and the rural environment beyond it. And I prepared for this. I had a look, Mr. Chairman, at the early decision of Judge Jackson that was the precursor to this going ahead, which is referred to in the Landscape Architects' Evidence, the case reference, And the court made the point that what was proposed then in the way of development of Jack's Point was in a rural environment. And so I do see this settlement as a rural, not an urban settlement. And the amount of open space and the way that the neighbourhood's been laid out in the form of villages or hamlets, and there was, if I may digress, some discussion about this issue during the unitary plan in terms of potential development in the rural areas outside the urban boundary. It seems to me that the Jack's Point settlement has been and was carefully designed to be a rural, not an urban village settlement, which is why I'm so opposed to the adjoining land to the south, the Jardine, the Marketable Station land, being transferred into an urban form. Because to me that's rural, that's urban sport.
Presumably I'll see you again for those areas.
Well, there's a limit to see what I can do, unfortunately. I mean,
just returning to...
I thought we'd be debating this, but I thought the evidence for Jardines would be on the table here. So that was unexpected to me that it isn't.
But just returning to my question, I take it, while you have that concern with the extension of the valley north of Gibbons, that I take from what you said that you see that if it were to occur, that you would see Jack's Point as being the transition at the southern end of that.
Exactly.
Exactly. So that's the point you're making.
Yes, I mean, I'm practical. I mean, you have to regard what's happened at Handy Down as going ahead. Council issued a non-notified consent off the back of Land Change 44 that appeals hadn't been resolved, and an unresolved is for plan review, but they've done it. There's an access road and they're starting to build it. So I now say, well, there's no point in debating whether the Handy Downs form of subdivision and writing and reviewing the plans and I've got it has, someone else has. There's no relationship to the former Jack's Point. And it won't look like Jack's Point. So that's going to happen, and if that now provides the opportunity to urbanise back to the corner and the boundary, the urban boundary of enables that, then I say that it should not include Jack's Point, and Jack's Point will be the ideal transition.
Right, for that.
Yeah.
But as it has shown at present, the entire zone is included within the urban growth boundary. Are you saying that the urban growth boundary and the zone boundary do not need to align?
Do not need to?
Align. They don't need to be in the same place. So in other words, the urban growth boundary could cut the zone. Is that what you're saying?
Well, my primary submission at the beginning, through John Williams, our co-owner, was that Handy Downs should be taken out. And it remains my position. And I don't really mind how it's done. And I saw Mr. Wells' evidence indicated that they were not essentially opposed to that happening. Because I think if urban development is going to track back the other way in the sort of form of the Henley Downs consenting that's already occurred, those entities, it just doesn't belong in Jack's Point, and it's better to take it out of there now. So, see, the thing is, it just what's been done with Henley Downs, if it stays in the zone, just basically impacts on the integrity of the master plan settlement that John Darby and his team designed. Because if you look at the original John Darby design for the Handley Downs, you'll see all of the features that are in Jack's Point. The open space through and between the individual neighbourhoods and of course the lower density. Now we've got a remnant of any sort of reserve, which is actually a drainage reserve, which the environmenter I remember told me years ago down at Thames Coromandel was not reserved for them. I remember a case about that. So their reserves are just on the, there's something on the edge. The landscaping is just typical urban landscaping, those soldier lines of trees down roads and stuff like that. I mean, it's so far removed from the Jack's Point model yes, it doesn't belong. And I don't know how much my co-chair told you about his meetings with residents that they did have in December, long after, of course, the whole submission process, but they did ask all of the people who had made submissions and they met me. And I laid out my view that Henley Downs now didn't belong, they're not going to be part of JPR away, they're not taking any of the infrastructure. And they seem to be comfortable with that notion. I don't know whether they said anything about it, that we're not going to be there too. But I am saying to you that that's what they said to me. That was my basic proposition and they didn't argue with it. And I think you look ahead to what apparently is going to happen through the rest of it, and why would you put Henley Downs into Jack's Point? So that other part there is again a recognition of the rural area and the special way in which these resource zones have been developed. So 4, my evidence refers to reverting to the notified plan change 44 Henley Downs zone provisions, and that is certainly an option. In some ways it's the easiest pathway. I could never understand how they could come back a year and a half later and change the whole thing. I know the hearing commission has looked at this within scope. But anyway, the other option is to simply utilise an appropriate residential zone, such as applied to residential development at the Lakehays estate, and this is the point I've just been making, just assume that if you are satisfied that this residential subdivision is the precursor to much more substantial development extending towards Franklin. I understand that the Jardine Family Trust Remarkable Station Limited submission seeking the opportunity for a substantial expansion of the limited opportunity for residential and village development at Homestead Bay in the existing Jack's Point zone provisions is not being addressed at this hearing. Now luckily I sat in this morning and I learned that some of the critical parts of that have been sold to someone else. So the whole thing is basically falling apart, crudely. And the owners there, despite entering into the stakeholders' deal, are now wanting to walk away from it. Certainly there is no evidence provided of the nature and extent that would be required to support such a major expansion opportunity, and I contrast that with the extensive evidence that was produced by the Jack's Point interests during this hearing. You know, landscape architects, planning assessment, infrastructure. I mean, we haven't got any of that and apparently it's going to come up later. So I can make no further reference to that submission, and for the purposes of today's hearing, the treat of the development opportunity is at Homestead Bay. That contained in the operative provisions for the Jack's Point zone. In my submission, the request for substantial development expansion should be refused, and of course part of that is my proposition that Jack's Point is the appropriate transition to rural, which is another reason why it should be refused. If you accept the contention that Henley Downs residential subdivision, should not be included within the Jack's Point zone, whether the Henley Downs residential development areas are transferred into a separate special zone or zoned residential by reference to other residential zones provided for in the proposed plan, the open space lands now owned by Jack's Point commercial interests should be retained within the Jack's Point zone. I mean, I didn't make that sufficiently clear perhaps in my evidence, but that's obvious. That land is part of the original Jack's Point master plan arrangements, the land that Mr. Schrantz was talking about this morning. In respect of those areas, previously notated FP1 and 2, their reclassifications are open space, and the provisions now proposed by the council, and I understand now agreed with the developer, to enable some limited form of residential development by identification of discrete preserved home sites is not opposed. And that's a personal, if you like, statement by me and Joan Williams as submitters. But I have said in my evidence that I was very much wanting to take a back seat on this issue of whether development should be permitted, because I realised that other people would be affected much more than we are. We're right up the back. Basically, we were as close to the mountain range as we could. And I listened to Mr. Schrantz this morning. I've read some of the material and I know of his involvement, despite the Jack's Point interest saying he wasn't entitled to be involved in Plan Change 44 because of covenants. And I listened to him this morning, and if you read Plan Federation 16 and the decision on Plan Change 44, I give up my sympathy for his position. And I do think that what he has to say, plus your consideration after a site visit, should certainly take priority over me saying to you, well, I'm prepared to go along with John Darby's latest proposals, which he showed me out in the field to get some houses up there.
Just ask a question at this point. I'm just wondering, if, in terms of what is urban character and what is rural character, generally that's an issue that suggests through landscape evidence.
Yes.
Quite volume.
Yeah.
Evidence case law, I guess, based on that kind of
yes.
concept.
Is it,
we don't have any evidence before us that would suggest that the Jack's Point area is rural in character rather than urban, do we?
You don't have any evidence before you?
Yeah, in terms of, say, landscape assessment, for example, is that a rural environment as opposed to an urban environment? Because on a certain point of view, it might be a high-quality urban environment.
I mean, if you could ask if someone next to me, Tim Williams, is capable maybe of speaking to that, but your rural experience, the hearing commission is, and you're going to make a site visit, and I put it to you as a resident there, that Jack's Point settlement is in a rural environment and it has carefully respected that rural environment. That's at the heart of the 95% open space, 5% built.
No, I understand that, but this, I know it's in a rural environment, we argue that rural, but is Jack's Point itself, the residential, the housing development in Jack's Point, those, well, I think they're called pods, are they themselves rural in character?
Yes, and I say that with the experience, if I may say, of extensive walking through Europe in rural environments where you see exactly these villages as you move through the countryside. And that was one of the things that attracted me instantly to the merits of the way this has been developed, is that it is exactly akin to the rural villages and hamlets that I have walked through in Portugal, France, Italy, Sicily. I mean, that's why I think it's such a good model, and it's a model that I took forward through the interim plan and obtained a new village zoning in Karaka, which is south of Auckland, basically modelled on the way John Darby has done this in a rural environment, using the same model of a village centre and hamlets with open space between. So yes. My own experience of what I've observed and the work I've done tells me that this is, I mean, it shouldn't have got consent if it didn't retain a rural character. And the main reason plans now to urbanise up through there, but it went into a rural environment, and that's what John Jackson said in his decision in 2003. So,
when you add in the village, you just probably developed that same rural
It won't be just me, of course, but again, the question is retaining the integrity of the existing plan and the proposals that were agreed and embodied into the stakeholders' agreement and the plan provisions for the extent of the village that was to be there. You start putting some speculative proposal for a school down there, or greatly enlarge up to, what is it, 26 hectares by borrowing a village that is now not going to be built by RCL because they choose not to, and would have been appropriate to that settlement area. And then you add that in and create something bigger. Well, then of course you do start impacting on that whole issue of the integrity of the way it was designed to fit into a rural environment. So yes, the extent to which you decide to allow that village to develop is going to be important. But again, you think of the hotels and the facilities and commercial activities that go along, and you can use Europe or Canada and places where there have been ski resorts established as well. I mean, it's not out of place to find visitor accommodation of some substance in rural areas, and it's all a question of how well it's done. But I do think the proposed expansion that immediately impacts on that issue. And the RCL proposal for creating a new development opportunity on the OSL land adjoining existing Jack's Point residential neighbourhoods, and Joe spoke about this one this morning, and community facilities, not to forget, right down where they try to jam in suggested school, are important community facilities, is opposed by Jack's Point interests as well as Jack's Point residents and the council. As Mr Coburn has identified, the development opportunity is nebulous given the commitment of a large portion of the land to essential wastewater infrastructure. The proposal must be dismissed. The presence of this vital infrastructure explains why the master plan for Jack's Point identified a 9-hole golf course on this location, and one of my attachments to my evidence was a master plan that I had, because we used it in the skydive hearing, that is more extensive than some of them and brings in Posse Water where the airport was, but you can see the whole of that land. The underlying endemic vegetation landscape that had been there was an original landscape that has since been destroyed by the unlawful farming activities, and the 9-hole golf course is there because this activity can be accommodated where treated wastewater is being disposed of by subsurface irrigation, as designed by Derby Partners, and has been in operation for nearly 10 years at the Omaha Beach Golf Course, North of Auckland, where I am a member. And that's a model that was taken over and had obviously been seen as being the appropriate use that could sit over the top of that subsurface irrigation and camp, because he designed it at Omaha and it's worked. Development of the Jack's Point Village in the form and to the extent originally proposed is not opposed, indeed supported. All residents who have purchased sections or established dwellings in the settlement are aware or should be that the development of the village is an integral part of the settlement design, as with the proposed lodge development. The proposed expansion promoted by Jack's Point commercial interests is another matter. That is not only an unplanned and substantial proposed addition to the village, but for some reason the Jack's Point commercial interests have made no reference to the effect of such an expansion on a key part of the Jack's Point golf course facility, which you'll see when you make the site visit. The existing golf course practice facilities are integral with and essential to a golf course of international standard, and this is arguably the very best golf course in New Zealand, rated by experts. I have seen no explanation as to how this expansion could proceed, and the golf course still be provided with appropriate high-quality practice facilities. I mean, I've played there a lot, and I thought about where could I practice before I start, and all the tourists who come and play there. That's obviously convenient to where you get your golf cart and you sign in and all the rest of it in the first seat. And I can't understand what's going to happen if those facilities were taken away. Indeed, as a member of the golf club, my expectation is there would be further development in this area beyond the existing driving range and practice putting green to include other practice areas that are available at other comparable international quality golf courses in New Zealand and, I should say, Australia. I don't want to go into detail about it, but for a course of this quality, there's more that should be in there for people to use. And if you're not, I mean, unless you're a golfer, there's no point in starting to talk about it. But it's there's a very, very good place that you can hit balls off, and there's a place to park, but there's more needed and more than you would expect at a course of this quality. And you will find at Carrie Cliffs or at Millbrook or at the Hills. You know, so there's stuff missing. And I looked at that area over the last few years and thought, well, it's forthcoming. I mean, it's fine. I'm prepared to wait. And now the owner and the developer of the golf course says, oh, we can put E over there or we can put Village over there. I couldn't understand why there's a drilling rig out there.
Just an interesting question, what your view on this is, if it's fine to have a disposal area, it's fine to have a golf course on that, but if we went to put a school on that, isn't that going to be a hail site?
Oh, you mean up in the RCL line plant?
Yeah.
Yes, I know. Well, that's why I say the whole proposition has to be dismissed, because as Mike Coburn has given you, there's a very good plan showing the grey areas, you know, underneath that are committed. to the infrastructure that all of us who live there or own properties there are absolutely critically reliant on, which is our effluent disposal. And it's just not feasible, apart from being quite unreasonable in terms of the expectations of the owners. I can't understand why they would walk the land. The top part of it is landscape protection area relating to the highway. The bottom part has got an effluent disposal field under it. And it is zoned open space, and the only uses permitted on it are recreational. That doesn't stop them from intensively farming it, and I've protested that to the KPR away, but yeah, even Mr. SB's design, I just can't see how any school would be able to give a consent with that waste field there. There are limitations on what you can do. Yeah. So National follows this NPS on urban development. I was a bit reluctant to write this, Mr. Chairman, but I felt I wasn't going to be able to come down without saying something. So this statement recognises the national significance of urban development, and the need to provide sufficient development capacity to achieve the purpose of the RMA. And I've got something there about in section 10, which I don't need to repeat for you, but just the preamble to this and the need to give effect to it. And so I go on to 11. While this UDC must be implemented by local authorities, in my submission, it cannot trump section 6 RMA matters of national importance. The ODP chapter 12 provisions make specific reference to the then proposed checkpoint settlement locations and the need for protection of visual amenity and landscape values in the development of the zone. Also, through appropriate development of the proposed settlement, the opportunity to enhance public access to the shores of Lake Rockitupu. In my submission, these values were reflected in the OTP objectives and policies and development controls and should remain at the forefront of the PDP objectives and policies, including the key provision ensuring no more than 5% of the settlement land will be utilised for built development. So my proposition here, if you can understand what I'm trying to put across, is that Section 6 in this location, in my view, mandates, or the two separate provisions, mandates and supports the 5%, 95%. And so looking at this land as being suitable under the under this national policy statement for intensification is not appropriate. And that's why I say you can't use the national policy statement to trump those values. Because if you want to do something meaningful to up the ante of capacity and more urbanisation of checks, pointing and destroy the very features of it that make it accord with those Section 6 characteristics.
It's put in the context of the salmon decision.
Mm.
We have to assume that the political policy statement is designed in such a way that Part 2 continues to operate. Is that what you're essentially saying? And that if there's a conflict between the two, then we need to move to the Part 2.
I do. The problem, of course, is resolved by getting the urban boundary right, as we were discussing before, and it's wrong. I mean, this circles back to the very same point. I mean, you avoid this difficulty of how to apply the statement to Jack's point. I mean, in reality, I've read Marie's submissions and I've read most of the evidence, and the only increase in density that's actually been asked for in the established residential parts of Jack's Point, and there is no more, apart from what you can put into the village, because that's all that's left to develop now. There's only 86, you know, so that's really fiddling on the margins. With all due respect, if you're looking for increasing urbanisation and intensity in Queenstown, you know, jamming some more into Jack's Point, and certainly of that sort of magnitude, is meaningless, because you're looking at it from a district-wide basis. So why try and apply it in a location where the settlement pattern, the subdivision, the roads, the titles, have all been sold in private ownership? Why try and do something in that area? And then Section 6 is my override on it as well. Under the heading National Significance, the NPS identifies the national significance of urban environments and the need to enable such environments to develop and change, and providing sufficient development capacity to meet the needs of people and community and future generations in urban environments. In relation to giving effect to this, I submit there is a broad policy context which will lead to the introduction of appropriate objectives and policies in regional policy statements. That's something which Mr. Geddes here has had a part in the last year or so, and the district plans relating to intensification and growth in urban areas. Whilst I accept that the directives of this NPS are also to be given effect to at the zoning level of plan provisions, in my submission the UDC document focuses attention on cities and towns, not villages or resort settlements. Further, the provision of a special zone at Jack's Point in the PGP must be viewed in context. I mean, that's increasingly something that I've seen as necessary, to look at all of the application of these things in the context that's appropriate. That context here is the inclusion of a special zone through variation 16 in the OGP, anticipating development of the Jack's Point settlement in the manner provided for by the objective and policies applying at Jack's Point. When settling on appropriate plan provisions in the PDP and considering the prospect of providing for additional residential capacity, the particular environment in which the settlement is located, and the extent to which the settlement development is now established should be taken account of. It is for these reasons I submit that the UDP provisions are not applicable within the Jack's Point zone, even if the hand-me-downs residential settlement is retained or sort of hung off the side of the zone, because the Jack's Point settlement, like the Millbrook settlement, should be excluded from the definition in Chapter 2. So Millbrook is out and Jack's Point is in, and I don't understand that. In any event, it would be inappropriate to apply the considerations of development capacity in the UDP to Jack's Point, given the extent to which the settlement pattern subdivision layout and housing development has been completed. Plan Change 44, other people, including my friend, the submissions for the council make reference to Plan Change 44 and refers to there being three appeals remaining before the Environment Court. Reference is also made to a proposed settlement through consent order. I am familiar with the situation relating to appeals on Plan Change 44, having filed a Section 274 notice in respect of the Henley Downs farm holdings, Henley Downs land holdings, those are just companies owned by John Darby Interest, and JPRA appeals. The other appeal by Scope Resources related to road access into the proposed residential development, and I understand it's been resolved between that party and RCL, and anyway it's moved now because the road's been approved. The sole purpose of my Section 274 notice was to request the Environment Court not to proceed to hearing on those appeals. They were getting themselves organised to get evidence prepared, but place them on hold so that potential changes to the ODP Jack's Point plan provisions were dealt with by this panel as part of the district plan review. The request was founded on the wording of the covenants registered over titles in the Jack's Point residential settlement areas, whereby property owners are prevented from making submissions and taking part in any plan change or an application for resource consent relating to Jack's Point, but the covenant does not prevent involvement in the district plan review. And just very briefly, because I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, even as late as the 2015, or maybe it was last year, the year before, the annual meeting of JPROA, the Jack's Point Commercial Interests had a lawyer there telling the residents that they could not take part in the district plan review, and I told everyone at the meeting that was wrong. And the reason I know it's wrong is that I brought my court proceedings for the Omaha Beach Residents Society, and I'll get to that in a minute, dealing with exactly the same covenant provisions where the residents wanted to engage in submissions to the proposed plan in that area, and there were questions being raised as to whether that was a breach of covenant. Now those proceedings, and I could give you the case reference, but I haven't bothered with it, those proceedings were resolved on that point in favour of the residents, and in fact before the trial actually started, the other party conceded that the wording did not prevent involvement in the district plan review. So I have High Court authority on my side, not to mention the plain reading of the words. And I just mention that because That's the very reason I went to Judge Jackson and asked the Plan Change 44 to be put on hold. This is our opportunity to be heard, and we can't be prevented from being heard.
I'm fascinated by that point, because Submitted here before us this morning said that her understanding was that it prevented people submitting on plan changes in any sort of sense, but not plan review.
Yeah.
Now, from what you've told me now, it's not because of the wording of the deed that it's like that, but it's because of the case you were
told. No, it is about wording of the deed.
The
proceedings in the High Court were declaratory proceedings, so you can ask the High Court to make a declaration as to the proper interpretation of words in the deed, and that's exactly what we did. In order that the people at Omaha could make submissions and be heard on a plan change up there, that when the covenant was argued by the people who were promoting what they wanted to do, it was preventing it. So what I'm saying, the very issue that arises here, but I'm only providing some information because we're all there anyway, and if they want to stop, they have to bring proceedings. So in that sense, it doesn't trouble you. But in case there's any misunderstanding about this, what I'm saying is, and I'm very happy to give you the decision, is that it's been tested, the same wording, and it's actually quite clear.
On a broader issue, though, can you actually have a covenant that takes away people's statutory rights?
Yeah, and there is a decision, of Judge Jackson's. It's about 2 years ago now, maybe read 3 years ago now, under the name of Coneburn, not one of the people.
Some of the reference.
That's right. And a ruling was made. Yeah, that's right. She was involved in it. But that was about people trying to be involved in Plan Change 44, which was a plan change.
The covenants that are entered on our titles are quite clear. Just that we are not able to be parties to consent or plan changes that are initiated by the developer or his nominated associated parties. And everybody understands that, and the decision of Jackson, I think it's Kinross, and Judge Jackson agreed with that interpretation. In fact, he took it further to say that not only could we not submit, but we were deemed to support any application by the developer and associated parties, which is something that we didn't actually expect or want. However, both the covenant and Judge Jackson's decision are silent on district plan processes initiated by the council. And at one meeting of the Residents Association, in answer to a question of mine, we were advised that we could submit to the district plan proceedings. Subsequently, we received an email, a copy of which I have, which advised us that we could not. So despite that, we have proceeded on the basis of our understanding of the covenants and the judge's decision, is that we are able to be legitimate parties to these hearings.
Thank you.
So I think Clive is quite right to refer to the private plan changes. So if you look at essentially the only area left for the developer now is the village, and that's something I'll get to later. You know, so all this business about how much land he owns is not the issue. All that needs to be developed to finish this all, and for us to get our residents association in our hands and be able to operate as a community, is to get the village done. And I can imagine that once the village proposal is formulated, it may be that some provisions, you know, the development controls are found to be a problem, and you can imagine the developer making an application for a plan change to fix those up. And then, of course, there are resource consent applications, and the developer can go ahead with those, and none of the residents can oppose it. And the Environment Court's decision that Clive has referred to gives some reasons as to why that's appropriate. But it absolutely is silent on plan review, and the law in relation to restrictive covenants is, because they restrain people's rights, they will be strictly construed against the person who takes the advantage of the covenant. So in the absence of it referring to preventing involvement in district plan reviews, then you clearly can. And I think that that becomes very significant, because this is the opportunity for people who live in a location like this to be involved in a review that sets the big picture in place. And that's why we have spent some time reviewing these provisions, and particularly the objectives and policies, because I think it would be a very brave developer that attempts subsequently to undo decisions on the plan review that set in place what the objectives and policies are, as opposed to trying or requesting some amendments to development controls or performance standards. And so I think that that's a very important concept. So anyway, getting back to this, so the whole point of that 274 was to interrupt that process so everyone could be heard before your panel. In the end, the appellants did not oppose this, and the judge placed the appeals on hold pending the plan review hearings. In the interim, the final form of draft consent order resolving those appeals has been signed off by me, and I understand other parties for imminent filing with the Environment Court. The reason agreement has been reached, that is to sign off Plan Change 44 outstanding matters, is that the appellants agree, as has the council, that the ODP provisions, otherwise thought to be amended through Plan Change 44, should remain in the wording found in the ODP zone provisions, save for any consequential or other amendments to recognise completed development such as infrastructure. That's why I signed it off, because basically they've agreed to leave everything as it is, and the purpose of that is exactly what I was seeking to achieve on behalf of me and others, which is we get a hearing here and everyone gets heard here. Aside from the new provisions introduced by Plan Change 44 to enable hand-me-downs development, the outcome of the agreed consent arrangements is that no substantive changes to the ODP will be made through the 44 appeal process, leaving the decision as to what changes, if any, there should be to the Jack's Point zone to the plan review process and decisions of this panel. I didn't add impossible appeal, but a process in which Jack's Point residents have been able to engage independently of Jack's Point commercial interests and the developer control JPROA. Now I move to, I'm just going to go through now some matters raised by my friend Ms. Parker Galloway. My response to these submissions will be confined to key matters that remain in dispute, as between the developer and Jack's Point residents who made submissions to the district plan review and are presenting evidence today. And I might say, Mr. Chairman, it isn't an easy thing for, and I should know, I've done a lot of work for community organisations, for ordinary residents to be involved in this sort of process. There were quite a few residents who put their hand up and put submissions in, but in a way it's not a surprise who's been left standing to come along and present to you. You know, people who have a background in these matters, or like Clive, have also a different sort of background and are prepared to come along and put evidence up. And so I think the involvement of the residents needs to be viewed in the light of that, people's concerns about whether they were entitled to be involved or not.
We do understand that.
In paragraph 7 of the submissions, references made to a significant proportion of the zone still being owned by the Jack's Point group. Now, in that regard, it's useful if you remember there was that map that John Darby produced, that very good ownership map. And if you have that handy, or you can recollect it, I just want to actually identify what is wrong with that submission. Reference to the plan produced by John Darby shows, and there's a key, that Jack's Point Group entities own 50% of the total land area. But in relation to the future development of Jack's Point, reference to the amount of land holding in the hands of the developer is misleading. A significant proportion of that land holding is the Jack's Point golf course, and the proposed changes to the zone provisions sought by the developer are irrelevant to that land holding, yes, of course, some of it is proposed to become educational village. But, you know, you look at that large area of land, well, sure, it's owned by the developer, but it's golf course. The other major portion of the land area owned by the developer is the areas previously labelled as FP1 and FP2, which knows all day. The former now to be relabeled OSG and provide for a defined number of reserved home sites, or that is proposed. You have a decision to make about that. But even if they were allowed, the sort of insignificant change of development obviously for those who go there. The latter now proposed to be relabeled OSL, and I'm going to say something about that in a little while. It should retain the ODP classification OS, and the activities under that notation from the ODP, with provision potentially for two preserved home sites. So yes, there is a development opportunity that you're going to make a decision about on a large land area that is insignificant. The changes to the land classification of these areas are supported, but with the OS notation replacing OSL and provision for a set number of separately identified preserved home sites is not opposed by me. But for the purposes of the plan provisions that are really in contention, remembering that the Henley Downs residential area is not owned by the developer, the relevant land holding in fact is the area of land owned by Jacks Point Village Limited and Jacks Point Village Holdings Limited. And you can see that on the map. And how much of it actually there is as a part of the entire amount that the submission refers to. Or the Jacks Point Village activity area and the proposed E or education activity area. It is this area that remains to be designed, consented and developed at Jacks Point. Remembering, and I'll put a footnote, that the lodge area up the top is not part of the Jacks Point interest, it's separately owned. So it's this area that remains to be designed, consented and developed at Jacks Point, and in that respect, the relevant land holding of the developer is not significant. Remembering that the original vision still promoted on the JBROA website is for a building footprint of no more than 5% of the total land area of Jacks Point settlement. The land holding plan shows the significant area is that comprising the completed residential land subdivision in private ownership. That is not in the hands of the developer, but the residents. So what is significant by comparison to what Jacks Point interest still owns is the grey area, with all that residential subdivision and the grey JPROA land, which actually is our land, that belongs to the residents through a community organisation. That is actually a far more significant development area than the village area. So the proposition telling you about how much land the developer owns, in my view, is misleading. The yet-to-be-completed village was an essential part of the Jacks Point settlement from the outset. The land holding and the location and of the dimensions of the ODP village area is recognised by residents as under the control of the developer, and that resource consent applications for development will be made absent any input from other private landowners within the settlement. The essential point of dispute relates then to the requested significant expansion of the village area over and above what is provided for in the ODP, whether as an e-activity area or an expanded village development area. Now turning to that, the developer's legal submissions make the strictly correct assertion that the proposed amended village development area is a reduction from the ODP position. But I think this is just another way of playing with numbers for areas. While true, this avoids recognising the effect of a proposed village expansion on existing residents within the Jacks Point settlement, which does not include the Henley Downs area, a separate settlement area as proposed in the notified plan change 44, which was to have its own village development. Either because RCL no longer wants a village within its residential development, or perhaps because of a commercial arrangement that has been made between the developer and RCL, resulting in dropping the Henley Downs village, the developer contends that the proposed expanded Jacks Point settlement village is an effective net reduction in both the ODP position and the notified position. But in relation to the proposed village within the Jacks Point settlement area, just distinct from the Henley Downs and the Homestead Bay settlement areas, the proposal now sought by the developer is substantially larger. As with other requests for change to the plan provisions controlling settlement at Jacks Point, this was never the subject of consultation with Jacks Point residents. The references in the evidence for the development to opportunities for development of a school, educational facility or healthcare facilities are also matters that have not been the subject of discussion or even advice to residents. What kind of school? A state or a private school? And importantly, what impact would this expansion have on the Jacks Point golf course? The golf course facilities that would necessarily be displaced are not even referred to in the evidence or submissions. Having agreed to drop previous proposals for much more extensive opportunities for development of buildings and residential occupation in the areas previously notated FP1 and FP2, the developer proposes that within the OSL, open space landscape, farm and recreational buildings of up to 10 metres in height could be consented as controlled activities. The OSL notation is applied appropriately to the open space land adjoining Jacks Point residential neighbourhoods, that's the way it is in the ODP, and is largely community JPROA owned. The specified activities in the OSL open space should reflect that and not enable farm buildings for general farming use. A non-residential farm building, and in our review, Mr. Chairman, I've added, or we've added the word non-residential, because you know what will happen otherwise. If it's just a farm building, what it will end up as, a non-residential farm building may be reasonably required in those areas now owned by the developer, which should have the OS classification as in the ODP, but not in respect of other open space land identified as OSL. Now, there were some questions of Joe this morning about the necessity for any farm buildings upon that land. Clive is far more familiar with the land than me because he's got interest in management interest in preserved land up there. But I did have the advantage of being taken up there and over the property by John Darby in December. There are cattle grazing up there, and I think they've been there for a long time. There isn't a single building up there. And the way in which that land is managed and operated for farming, it's hard to conceive of why a barn or an implement shed is required. And so there is, I think, a question of what the activity status should be. But the main thing is that we need to be very careful to ensure that provisions that are just put in like this don't end up having unintended consequences and adverse effects.
Is one of those potential effects of concern to you is it may create a permitted baseline argument for a non-farm building?
Well, it may create a permitted baseline, I suppose, although I don't get overly... I mean, we need to get these provisions right now, and the most important thing is that land was previously correctly in the ODP as OS, and I'll get to that later, and I've inserted it in our review, and OS means, and it was that handy house land right through underneath Peninsula Hill, means pastoral and arable farming. That's what they do up there. And endemic revegetation. That's what it always was. So when that changed from FP1 and FP2, it shouldn't have gone to OSL. It should go to OS. OSL is recreation and open space, and it's the land around the Jacks Point residential settlement. And we've already had, I don't want to bore you with this, trouble with farming operations that are very destructive of the environment up there. So,
when I asked a question, because of Ms. Kluger, about this issue of buildings in that area, part of her response was that the recreational activities up there might be buildings. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, certainly not up where John's land is. I mean, I learned today, to my surprise, because I talked to him in December about the need to get this trail built. I've given you the trail map, and I noted that the landscape designer who gave evidence for the council was asking what is the geographical location of it. Now that straggler's loop track is going to be absolutely outstanding. It hasn't been built yet, but I've learned we have to be patient at Jacks Point. But you know that eventually, because of the stakeholders' need, people have a contractual obligation to put it in. And it isn't just the local residents that use it, it's the public that get access to it as well. There will be running and all sorts of, you know, people will use it for all sorts of activities. And now Mr. Schrantz is saying that there was a proposal to shift its location. And I'm sorry, but you can't help feeling, if you look at the trail map that I gave you and he did, that the obvious reason to move it out of the centre of that land, where it should be, is to make room for people to live up there. And these are the sorts of things that need to be borne in mind. And I certainly don't think at the moment that there's I wouldn't say here that there couldn't be a justification for putting a farm building up there. But I think Clive's better to speak to me than me about the historical degree of farming activity and whether it's ever justified any sort of building, so he has a farming background that I don't have.
Well, then, from what you've said, there's a proposal for a trail. Would the activities on that trail require attending a high building?
No, in relation to that. They don't require any buildings. I've walked all the trails that are available on Jack's Point at the moment. Of course there isn't a building. There isn't even a building if you walk all the way out to Kelvin Heights, which I've done. I mean, if you go on any of the dock walks, sure there are huts, but that's just at night. None of the walks are of those dimensions. So no, there is signage and is the thing we need. And of course the farming needs to be compatible with the primary activity and use of the open space, which is recreational, and section 60, because all of this is about public access as well to and from Lake Wakatipa. And it was, if you read the 16 decision, which is so useful, just to tell us always a lot, that was seen by the decision makers allowing the sun to go in as one of the trade-offs for allowing that development to happen for those public access opportunities. And why would we be surprised, as planners or lawyers in this field, to see that as part of the decision making? So otherwise, and apart from the identified preserved home sites, if you decide indeed that they're appropriate, there should be no buildings in the areas that have the primary purpose of providing for recreation and outdoor activities and are valuable high amenity open space. That was the deal that the Jack's Point interest signed up to in the stakeholders' deed. The legal submissions make reference to the UDC, on which I've already made submissions. However, in paragraph 97, the submissions refer to the relevance of the UDC, and I quote, by virtue of the district containing a high growth urban area, true, and Jack's Point being included in the urban growth boundary, I don't think it should, and clearly destined to be developed into an urban area of significant size. That's what the submissions say. Dealing as we are here with the proposed Jack's Point zone in the PDP, I submit there is no basis on which the developer can contend that the settlement could be developed into an urban area of significant size, even by reference to the inclusion of the zone in the zone of the RCL residential development over three times the density provided for in the ODP and development of the Jack's Point village area, which will have some residential. It still isn't an urban area of significant size. In my submission, the RCL form and extent of residential development does not fit within the Jack's Point zone in terms of a settlement pattern and layout, and is in breach of the stakeholders' deed. A village development within the land area and in the form identified in the ODP, in combination with the existing completed subdivision and residential development at Jack's Point, would not create an urban area of significant size. In paragraph 136 of the legal submissions, it is contended there were no opposing submissions to the specific village and e-activity areas as notified, but then they acknowledge that there are submissions in opposition seeking to reinstate the ODP position generally. As the Council has recognised in its response through reports and expert evidence, the submission of my co-owner, Joan Williams, and other residents provides scope for opposing the developer's request for expansion of the village into the proposed e-activity area and the e-activity area itself. In paragraph 9 of the submissions, it is contended that changes to the nature and scale of development in the zone in order to reach completion have been squarely anticipated since the zone's inception. In my submission, that is not so, certainly not by Jack's Point residents. If, by Jack's Point commercial interests, that has never been shared with the residents in an open and transparent way. My evidence references the reasonable expectations of those who have acquired land within the residential settlement areas. The submission even contends an expectation of a need to change and evolve the ultimate vision for the zone up to full development, whatever that means, is a fact that has always been expected. It is not a fact that has always been expected. The reference to non-objection obligations contained in land covenants is not apposite. covenants do not prevent resident owner participation in a review of the district plan, nor should they. In my submission, potential purchasers within the residential settlement were and are entitled to interpret the covenant provision as enabling the developer to obtain the necessary resource consents and, if appropriate by plan change, private plan change, make alterations to the development controls applying to buildable land areas still owned by the developer and yet to be developed. And as I've said, that's the village. Bottom line, that is the village. And maybe some house sites that you would define exactly as to how many and where. The purpose being of making a plan change or a resource consent application to complete development in accordance with the master plan settlement design and in accordance with the stakeholder's deed. That deed imposes continuing obligations upon the developer in relation to the scale, intensity and form of development. In my submission, reference to the need for the developer to have flexibility to complete development is disingenuous. What the developer has sought to achieve in respect of its land holdings at Jack's Point through the PDP plan provisions that drafted and presented to the council for adoption into the proposed district plan, and then through submissions to the plan review, proposed significant changes to the original vision. Now the legal submissions refer to putting in place a planning framework that will set up the appropriate framework for completion so the final vision can be realised. In other words, a new vision the developer has, different from the original vision. And that obviously is what we're here to say no to. A relevant Auckland unitary plan decision. As part of the proposed unitary plan, what was the Omaha South Special Zone in the former Rodney District Council District plan was proposed to be replaced by the Omaha South Precinct. Planners up there, Mr. Chairman, are very keen on precincts.
We
won't go there.
Exactly.
Love something new. The special zone was established for a plan variation to enable a master plan coastal settlement at Omaha Beach, north of Auckland. This is a bit like Groundhog Day for me, see. This was designed by Darty Partners at Omaha South and incorporated a golf course development, open space areas and residential settlements in discrete neighbourhoods. All titles are subject to covenants in more or less the same form as those employed at Jack's Point, and all building development is subject to design guidelines and approval by a design review panel operated under the auspices of the Omaha Beach Residents Association formed as part of the development of the settlement. All landowners must be members of OBRS. And actually, as I'm so familiar with that, the Jack's Point work and all the documentation is simply the next stage and a vast improvement on the work that was done. And I have freely offered that Jack's Point work because I think it's so good to other people as the way they should do similar forms of development. So I don't have a problem with the framework. So the authors of the proposed plans, again without consultation, funnily enough, with the Omaha people, notified a replacement Omaha South precinct in a different form to the special zone provisions that had applied from the commencement of development of the land. Built development there is now largely complete. The Residents Association submitted an opposition to the notified precinct provisions, pointing out that the residential settlement subdivision, riding and infrastructure development was completed under the ODP, and residential building development was also near complete, again under the provisions of the ODP, which provisions were referenced to the design approval process and compulsory membership of the OBRS. The community sought retention of the operative plan provisions. A copy of the recommendation of the independent hearing panel, adopted as the decision of the Auckland Council and now of course operative, is attached as Appendix C. The alternative precinct provisions presented through legal submissions and evidence from the Association's planning consultant were approved. These revised precinct provisions carefully followed the wording of the operative special zone with consequential amendments that aligned the terminology and wording of rules to the standardised form employed for the unitary plan and deleted provisions requiring development contributions for specific infrastructure development, which of course have been completed. So with the planner, we made the sensible deletions and changes to bring the thing up to date. Otherwise, the IHP endorsed the continued use of the objectives and policies and controls on development that were at the OGP. You're, of course, not bound in any way by the entry plan panel, but I thought it might be useful if you could have regards to their views as to what should be done in what are very similar parallel circumstances as we have here.
I'm impressed by the brevity. It's clear they didn't have to comply with the Act and the way we did.
That's a very good part of the plan writing. They ran out of time, Mr. Chairman. It was hopeless in the end. They needed another 6 months. There are decisions on major zonings that have got no record in the decision at all, simply the outcome. And by and large, most of the decisions are not even referenced to submissions, which is one of the reasons why we ended up with appeals in the High Court.
I can see that indeed.
But this is quite good. I mean, but succinct. Well, to be fair, we had to think about the enormity of the task.
Yes.
That was impossible, really. The evidence group revised Jack's Point Zone provision. So, Appendix A, there's a track change version. And you might like to go through, I mean, obviously you'll look at this later. There's an opportunity for discussion with principally Tim, because he had the time to look at this more closely than Scott did, and me. And I will just talk about some of the key things that I and he have altered in making this, and then Appendix B is just a clean copy version. So if I might, what I'll do is I'll just go through and highlight the key things that we've done. I have prepared a revision of the proposed checkpoint zone provisions, utilising the revised version provided by the Council's planner with their Section 642A report. I've done this in collaboration with Tim Williams of Southern Planning, although I recall he is submitting as a resident, an individual, but like me, he has skills, which, I mean, you can't ignore. So, obviously, I went to him and asked for his input. Revisions are identified in the usual way, including colour, stripe through, and underline. I'm not saying it couldn't have been done better, and there still might be a few mistakes in it, but it had to be done under considerable pressure of time, and I hope it's going to be helpful. In the interest of brevity, I will only refer in these written submissions to key changes that have been made. I also note the revision removes all reference to the hand-me-downs residential development on the basis of my request that this residential development be provided for through a separate zone, either as originally promoted or otherwise zoned separately. If your decision is that the hand-me-downs residential settlement should remain in the Jack's Point zone, those provisions would need to be reinstated. And by the way, we haven't even attempted to do anything to the structure plan. The main thing from my point of view was to get the wording right and the diagram can follow. The purpose of the zone has been rewritten because we consider the notified provisions were wordy. Things like creating environmentally sustainable communities, I have a real problem with. And did not prescribe a clear purpose for the zone. So if you look at it now, it's nice and brief. And interestingly, I was looking for something to base it on, as you normally would, that you might find in the plan already. And so the first paragraph of the Millbrook Resort Zone PDP provisions was used as a template. Unfortunately, their purpose then goes on in a great big long wordy thing under purpose, describing what all the activity areas are about, so I ignored that. So we've got a much briefer purpose there. And then the most important thing for us has been rewriting the objectives and policies. In my submission, the objective and associated policies are the most important provisions for any zone and should reflect the key environmental factors and intended planning outcomes for, in this case, the existing substantially developed Jack's Point settlement. The ODP objective and policies were used as the template with amendments made to make explicit recognition of the settlement's location in relation to outstanding natural features and landscapes, section 6B, and the protection of those from, sorry, there's a mistake, that should be inappropriate, as you know, inappropriate subdivision use and development, and the maintenance and enhancement of public access to Lake Waikaremoana. Now, someone asked Jo a question about that this morning, about the wording that she wanted to use. She said something like, that means the experts would decide, and I'm sorry, I don't want to be disrespectful to her view, but as a lawyer, I find that quite wrong. The objectives should actually reference deliberately and give effect to Section 6 in this case, and also, of course, the regional policy statement. And I did find that the existing policy, the ODP, which nonetheless did serve its purpose, definitely needed, and Tim and I both agree, needed strengthening to reference into those natural features and landscapes. That is the environment that the Jacks Point settlement sits within. So you will see those words in there. Developed and maintained in a manner which provides for the protection of outstanding natural features and landscapes and the maintenance and enhancement of public access to and along Lake Wakatipu, and recognises the value of areas of open space to residents and visitors, amenity and outlook. These are absolutely key to us, and I want to be quite transparent about this. They're key because this is our chance at the plan review to put in front of you for your decision things that we think are absolutely important. And if the developer comes along subsequently with a private plan change, then they've still got to confront these provisions if you decide that these are the most appropriate. So that's why we see that getting these objectives and policies right is important, because any plan, private plan changes in the future should only be about development controls and density limits and things like that, and they would still sit under the objectives and policies. So we focus bulk of our attention on those. The recognition of these matters of national importance has been carried through into amendments to the associated policies. We have reinstated the methods of implementation section of the ODP zoning provisions, referencing council-approved development controls and design guidelines for buildings and landscaping, and the Jacks Point stakeholders' deed, taken out in the proposed plan provisions written by Jacks Point interests, as they have acknowledged, they need to go back in. As I said in my evidence, the Jacks Point provisions for residents and people who purchase and commit there is a total package, and the whole thing operates together. And that is absolutely key, and there is nothing wrong at all with identifying that there are other methods by which the objectives and policies of the plan could be achieved. And this mechanism, which is a John Darby Partners mechanism that he's used at Omaha, as I've told you, is one that I absolutely support. But you can't take away an important part of that total package, which is the stakeholder's deed in this case, and the requirement for design guidelines implementation, which is reflected in the high quality of built development that sits into that building pool. Amendments have been made to delete reference to the education activity area. That's kind of obvious, I guess, from our perspective. The intent of the changes is to retain the Jacks Point Village area as provided for in the ODP. Changes to enable a greater scale of development, for example, height increase, have been accepted. The limited extent of provision for mining within the Jacks Point settlement has been made explicit. At one stage, there was even a proposition, but the council planner wrote it out to allow mining in our open space areas. I mean, that could happen, in other words, across Joe's back boundary. And permitted activities in the open space landscape, and those are the areas that are largely JPROA owned, but also includes the land of RCLs, have been revised by me by deleting reference to farming, farm buildings, farm and farm access tracts, but making provision for sheep grazing and production of hay and silage, as I understood had been agreed with the JPROA chairman. And this goes back to the whole question of, all of a sudden, cattle, instead of remarkable station sheep, arrive on the JPRO land with its beautifully hard landscape, dry stone walls and fences that were only put ever there to accommodate light sheep grazing, and the resultant damage resulted in many complaints from residents. And the inappropriateness of that form of farming on land that my grandchildren and other people's children who are here as residents should be able to go and play on, and that people can walk through where the trails are. I have added the OS classification and uses from the ODP, as this should apply to the FP2 land, as it does at the moment, to reflect the pastoral farming that's there now and which is appropriate the density provision has been changed, and I'm just trying to pick out the key areas, Mr. Chin, but I think it's on page. Sorry, let me just find that. Yes, density is on page 41.24 of my document. So just I'm just interested in density within Jack's Point. I forgot about what they might do at Henley Downs, so this happened now. So I changed those numbers so that the density numbers now align with the Jack's Point density master plan approved by the council in June last year, and John Dunn introduced that as part of his evidence. The other approach, so that's why I put that in, that was what was seen as acceptable to round out the remaining residential development within the Jackson Point settlement. And my argument is, well, there's very little yet to be done, and if that density worked in June last year, why not just carry it through? The other option that I'm quite happy about, because after all we all agree to it, effectively in the ODP, is to retain the wording of that ODP, which enables changes to density within the neighbourhoods, just like that master plan was altered and approved by the council in June last year, provided the overall density remains within the 10 to 12 dwellings per hectare, which is fundamental to what we all understood when we bought into that development. So I quite like the ODP provisions in that regard, because they do give some flexibility and the numbers can be adjusted, provided at the bottom of the page when you come to the total, you've got the 10 to 12. And if you look at the plan that was done by Derby Partners last year and approved, you'll see that very calculation. Obviously some changes have been made, and I think over in the Coneburn area the numbers obviously have been lifted, but the overall number still meets the ultimate, and that's another method. So I actually consider this as preferable for flexibility reasons, and the provision has been utilised over time to amend density. The provision for farm buildings for maximum height of 10 metres has been altered to make it clear that this is only in respect of non-residential buildings, and you'll know the reason why. Then it becomes a so-called farmhouse, but it actually isn't. I've amended the provision in relation to non-notifications. I should maybe just refer to that, because this has got something to do with the covenant and the decision made about somehow the covenant can be treated as written approval. That can be relied upon to disregard effects. I've written that, so it must be a written approval to the relevant application given under Part 6 of the RMA instead of being implied from the wording of the non-objection covenants. One of the problems with that hearing, Mr. Chairman, was that there was no representation there for the residents. I mean, I'm somewhat surprised the judge didn't see it necessary to make sure that someone representing the people affected by the covenants was heard. So the parties to that hearing were the interest represented by Ms. Baker Galloway, which are the commercial interests at Jack's Point, and the council. And the council argued the case about covenants restraints, and the developer interest argued as to what the extent of them should be. I think that was very unfortunate, because whilst I don't have a problem with the first part of Judge Jackson's decision, it's a declaratory judgment, I have very much a problem with this decision that somehow you can write into that a Section 95, Section 104 written approval from a covenant that's over my title to a particular specific application that of course I've never seen and I never gave approval to. If that decision had been made and I'd been involved on behalf of residents or someone else, I can see it having been appealed. It wasn't. What I've tried to do is to write into that non-notification provision some wording that makes it plain that if you produce a written approval, it must be a written approval that we all understand. You know, someone puts an application forward for development, takes the plans around to the neighbourhood and gets them to sign it. Not saying, well, here's a copy of the covenant that was put on their title in 2010, and that's a written approval from all the people in Jack's Point, or even the neighbours. So I tried to write something that will work for that. Mr. Geddes and I lastly favour the continuation of controlled activity consenting for residential dwellings as in the ODP, essentially for the reasons expressed in the section 42A4. We think there's a need to retain that because although the process is working extremely well and has, I mean, we have to be sensible and look to the future. And if for some reason the design approval process becomes less than satisfactory, the council is the overseer. But I have not included a rule requiring this in our revision, as we've tried to do this on a joint basis, and both Tim and Scott have different views. So I simply recorded that quite a nice different position.
Now, were you proposing, well, last question, any questions?
A lot of mention has been made today of the 95.5, but when you look at the area encompassed by the big black line, the reality is that 95% open space, 5% developed, but the area that is developed is very much concentrated in one part of that. It's not even over the whole area, is it?
Sorry, can you...
The area that was going to contain nearly all of the population is confined to this area here, isn't it? It's not spread evenly over the entire zone.
Well, absolutely not, and I think, I hope when you visit there you'll understand why. And I think it also goes back to the Cambridge study. The others can speak about this, but the whole purpose of the study, unsurprisingly, is to identify areas within that particular landscape that could absorb or accommodate development. And that's why the housing settlement is where it is. And I believe that when you make that site visit, I look when I can out of the plain window at it as well. I've looked at it from the other side. It's a matter of interest to me, as you might imagine, to see just how well the outcome has been absorbed into the landscape and ask myself, is this sitting alongside the remarkables the way it should? And I think it does. And when you go on the site visit, you need to drive up the road that takes you up to the preserved sites. It says drive up. And look down across at the settlement and look to yourself at it. And in fact, the most intrusive buildings, although admittedly this is partly as a goal, but I have walking trails as well, the most intrusive buildings for me, unfortunately, are the ones that have already been built on the preserved sites. By contrast to the buildings within the settlement, which for me, particularly partly coming from Auckland, but also looking at some of the grandiose houses that have been built some places in Queenstown. One of the standouts is how relatively modest the buildings are within the neighbourhood, including buildings that have been built by young families with children, they've been able to afford it. Right across the road from us is something that would maybe be 100-120 square metres. So you've got the buildings are modest and they have a form that collectively makes it work, whereas out on the preserved park sites, and also reinforced by a decision that I can't understand, to insist on in a high proportion of stone, you have your own ideas about them. I find that the buildings out there are much more intrusive. They're large, very large, some of them, and they look like sort of stone forts to me, some of them as well, I'm sorry. So the funny thing is that the collective village areas and the way they've been developed, and the fantastic landscaping on the open space, and every house has to be built with the landscaping completed, it's been an awesome outcome. And so I think that all actually up there works extremely well. I think that's why it's so good. Putting it like that, the way it has to be done.
Now, just park for a moment the issue of the proposed, RCL proposed school site. If this area were to remain as one zone, given you've explained to us quite properly that apart from the village, it's almost a done deal now, it's largely developed, all the process being developed, what are the specific adverse effects you would think would occur if it stayed as part of one zone?
If
Henley Down, if this whole area stayed as one zone?
My first starting point is, it isn't of course the same as what it was supposed to be. I mean, Henley Downs was not only meant to be no more than 500 dwelling units, not nearly 2,000, but the design of it, and there is somewhere in the documents, the Derby Partners design of it, looked like the layout and design of the residential that's in Jack's Point, with all the open space and the reserved land and everything.
I fully understand that, but in terms of this area, is your concern that it provides a bit difficult with these plans, but...
You mean the Henley Downs area?
There's the Henley Downs there.
Yeah.
There's the Jack's Point area.
Yeah.
Is your concern that if this remains as part of one planning parcel, if you like, that someone would be able to come along later and ask for greater densification in here, or for residential development within the OSA?
I'm sorry, it's an adverse effect in my view, and a regrettable one, but it's going to happen. So I put that to one side, and I've all focused on the right planning approach in this district plan review to dealing with something that is conventional residential. And the best example I can see that reminds me of is Lake Hayes. I've been there. You know, it looks like Lake Hayes, so why put it in a special resort zone? Why not move it out of there and join it into apparently what's going to happen in the future, moving north? Because if that urbanises, don't get the other way, and this urban boundary seems to be a precursor to that, so I presume Marion Reed, I think her name is right about what's going to happen, then it's a mistake to put it in Jack's Point now, because it's completely an orphan. I mean, it's an orphan piece of development in a way that was never meant to happen. Now, RCL have got their way about that, and they're underway. They've got scrapers in there now, but I can't see why you put it in there, because I think at best it would only be an interim solution.
From a
logical process of putting the building blocks of the plan into place, that's really why I'm making that argument.
Would there be scope, if we were to agree with you, though, to apply low density residential Henley Downs? Is there scope for the submission?
I'm not asking you to do that. I'm asking you to do what the submission asked for.
Which is
to put them out in another zone.
That is another zone.
Sorry? What is it?
Like low density residential.
Oh, could we apply whatever the zone, appropriate zone
is?
Well, I'm sorry, I can't answer that, Mr. Chairman. What you can do is use the zone that's already purpose made out of the notified plan change 44, and you've got scope from my submission and I think Clyde's submission. A much more logical process is just to give it an ordinary residential zone, because it's just an ordinary residential subdivision. It's not a Jack's Point subdivision.
Although we don't have any submissions from anybody asking us to do that.
I haven't been able to give the time to answering that question.
I understand that. Yes.
I'm sorry, I apologise, but I simply can't answer that question. But if you had the opportunity, you'd put a zone over that that's appropriate, and zone the rest of it future urban, if that's the methodology you're using.
The reason I asked my original question was, often when people come to hearings like this, the concerns they're expressing, I'm not calling your concerns academic, but they're generally because people are concerned that the planning framework will allow something to happen in their area which will drastically have an adverse effect on it, like doubling the density or allowing a lot of high density development. But you're not actually arguing that, you're arguing more from a, I suppose, in terms of zoning provisions.
Well, you look at the objectives and policies that we're promoting, what they've got and designed there, we've got part approved, doesn't it? And it never would. It even struggles to meet the ones that the council has suggested in my respectful opinion. It doesn't have any of the right ingredients of this settlement as it was master planned.
A couple of days ago we asked, it might have been one of the witnesses for Jack's Point Group, as it's structured at the moment, you've got one set of objectives and policies for the whole area, and you've got one set of rules, and in particular with the rules, when you read through them, it's quite hard work, because you're sort of going, one thing you're looking at Jack's Point SH1, and next rule relates to RHDG, and it's completely unstructured. Now, the possibility we've raised, which is typically what you get with a zoning approach, is given that the activity area is de facto zones, is to group the objectives and policies and the rules, say, into a series of blocks. One for the Jack's Point RJP ones, another one for the Henley Downs ones, and and another lot for the open space zones and a final one for the village zones. And you could do it that way, which would achieve largely what you are trying to do, isn't it?
Well, yes, sir. I agree some work could be done. I thought the operative plan provisions were much easier to follow in that regard, and I thought, you know, the pages and pages of tables with ticks and crosses isn't my cup of tea. The Omaha rewrite I didn't bring with me, but that had neighbourhoods as well, but that was kind of a table, and then you had building height, you had this site coverage, and
I know
then you put a header for each of the neighbourhoods, and where you had, you know, medium or high intensity, well, you simply have your different numbers. And in terms of, if you were writing this plan, these plan provisions, I absolutely agree. There's got to be a better way of writing them. But the most important thing is that actually it's fundamental to the way these neighbourhoods are placed in the environment. And John and his team did such a good job that there are different factors and characteristics that lend themselves to different forms of intensity. So I think that when you've got a special zone, you need to go to the trouble of getting all that right. Whether this is easy to read, yeah, absolutely. I worked on this over the last 2 days and Tim put some in, and I'm sorry I didn't do it earlier, but I wasn't in a position to do a complete rewrite. I'd like to see it set out quite differently, but that would have taken a lot more time.
Guys, so imagine it would take a many year of it just to get where you are.
Sorry?
Imagine it would take a many year of it tablets just to get where you are.
But then the plan that I worked with at Omaha, she worked on it, and we got it all. I mean, I thought it was a lot better than this, a lot easier for people to work with. So yes, I believe it could be done differently. The main thing is, and I do think that visiting the area and looking what's actually built, I mean, so much of it is there to see, including the maturity of the planting through some of the neighbourhoods I'd like you to walk through, where the walkways can take you between and amongst the neighbourhood housing, and it's the total package that's achieved that, and there's a variety of housing type, but it could certainly be better set out. I think it's quite messy.
Before you ask any more questions.
No, that's all right. Yeah, that's
all right. I'm going to take the afternoon. And we will reconvene at 3:00.